The Nazi Roots of the Brussels EU. Chapter 6. 800 years after Magna Carta, the rule of the Brussels EU would end centuries of freedom and independence in Great Britain. Here is a law which is above the king, which even he must not break. This reaffirmation of a supreme law and its expression in a general charter is the great work of Magna Carta, and this alone justifies the respect in which men have held it. Winston Churchill, 1956. Of all the proud histories of freedom and independence in Europe that totalitarian rule under the Brussels EU would bring to an end, the termination of the centuries-long history of liberty and self-government in Great Britain must surely rank as one of the most tragic. To the people of a country that has twice played a critical role in preventing the chemical, oil and drug cartel from conquering the world and delivering of Europe into the very hands that caused two world wars is an event that over a million of their brave ancestors gave their lives trying to prevent. Looking further back in history, it's similarly noteworthy that Britain, through England, its largest member country, also gave the world the Magna Carta. A charter widely viewed as one of the most important legal documents in the history of democracy. Signed in Runnymede in the English county of Surrey in June 1215, this charter stood for centuries as a bulwark against tyranny in England. By recognising rights such as habeas corpus, the right of a detained person to a hearing before an independent court to determine whether the detention is lawful, and placing even sovereigns and magistrates within the rule of law, England's Magna Carta led the world into the development of constitutional law. Unbeknownst to many British people, however, the Brussels EU so-called European Arrest Warrant passed in 2002 has repealed habeas corpus. Similarly, the Lisbon Treaty repeals not only Magna Carta's protections against arbitrary and capricious rule, but also the very sovereignty of the British Parliament, a body that has been a model for parliamentary systems throughout the world. A proud history, Britain twice defends the world from the oil and drug cartel. Britain's entry into World War I took place on the 4th of August 1914, when its then Prime Minister, Herbert Asquith, declared war on the German Empire in response to the invasion of Belgium by Germany. Amongst the many factors that were crucial to ensuring Germany's defeat in World War I, the key role of the British Royal Navy, the largest navy in the world at that time, is frequently overlooked. In fact, so important was the role of Britain's navy in World War I that without it, there could be little doubt that the country would have been unable to stay in the war. Although fighting only one fleet action during World War I at Jutland on the 31st of May 1916, the British Navy was successful in preventing Germany's navy from escaping the confines of the North Sea. In so doing, it played a decisive role in enabling maritime trade between Britain and its allies to continue throughout the war. Along with the mass army it provided, Britain was also the arsenal and financier of the alliance and decisively withstood even Germany's declaring of unrestricted submarine warfare in February 1916. As such, without Britain's efforts, it's clear that the outcome of World War I would have been very different. Britain's entry into World War II took place on September 3, 1939, when it declared war on Germany following the German invasion of Poland. Bravely refusing an armistice with Germany, Britain's role in defending the world against the cartel for a second time was no less crucial than it had been 25 years earlier. Under Winston Churchill, the British Prime Minister and arguably the most remarkable wartime leader in modern history, Britain stood firm against the cartel-funded war effort and succeeded, again, almost unimaginable odds in forcing Hitler into a two-front war that was ultimately to become Germany's undoing. Nevertheless, the forces of the cartel began regrouping and plotting in secret against Britain, with only a few years of World War II having ended. The Action Committee of the United States of Europe plot to lure Britain into the Brussels EU. A little-known committee, whose history has been largely hidden from the British people, the Action Committee for the United States of Europe, was founded by Jean Monnet on the 13th of October 1959. Monnet, a wheeler-dealer who was never elected to public office in a democratic election, had previously been the high authority of the European Coal and Steel Community, the ECSC, a post for which he had resigned a month earlier. The meetings of the Action Committee began in January 1956 and were held in private. Right from the start, Monnet made it very clear what was intended. In a letter sent to the politicians and trade unionists who joined in forming the committee, he stated the following, quote, "Mere cooperation between governments will not suffice. It is indispensable for states to delegate certain of their powers to European federal institutions mandated by all the participating countries taken as a whole. At the same time, the close association of Great Britain with these new achievements must be assured." End quote. In short, the committee's ultimate goal, as stated at its inception, was to arrive by concrete achievements at the United States of Europe. Subsequently, in a letter dated the 28th of September 1968, Jean Monnet announced that the committee had decided to invite the three main British political parties to join as full members. Moreover, he stated outright that the political parties and trade unions which made up the committee were, quote, "determined to pave the way for British entry into the European community as soon as possible," end quote. Unknown to the British people, however, the longest-serving member of the committee's executive committee had been the German Kurt Georg Kiesinger, who sat on it between January 1956 and May 1965. Kiesinger had been a member of the Nazi Party. His Nazi Party NSDAP membership number was 2633930. And he had worked in the Nazi Foreign Ministry's radio propaganda division during World War II. He later became Chancellor of West Germany, a post he held from 1966 to 1969. Other notable members of the committee had included the Italian Aldo Moro, its political secretary between May 1959 and December 1962. Leading up to World War II, Moreau had been a member of the Fascist University Organization, a group sponsored by Mussolini's Fascist Party. Moreau eventually became Prime Minister of Italy, a post he held twice, from 1963 to 68 and from 1974 to 76. Astonishingly, however, despite the above facts, the leaders of all three British parties responded extremely positively to Monet's invitation. Prime Minister Harold Wilson, for example, on behalf of the governing Labour Party, wrote, quote, "The aims of the Action Committee are in close conformity with those to which the Labour Party subscribes," end quote. He added that he was pleased to accept the invitation for the Labour Party to join the committee as a full member. Wilson nominated three members of the party, George Brown, Walter Padley, and Michael Stewart, to serve as its representatives. Anthony Barber, chairman of the Conservative Party, replied in a similarly positive fashion, saying that after a consultation with his colleagues, he had great pleasure in accepting the invitation and that his party would value its membership. Barber also nominated three members of his party: Mr. Reginald Maudling, deputy leader of the party, Sir Alec Douglas-Hume, spokesman on foreign affairs, and Mr. Selwyn Lloyd, former foreign secretary and chancellor of the Exchequer, to serve as its representatives. Jeremy Thorpe, leader of the Liberal Party, was equally enthusiastic, saying that he would join the Action Committee with high hopes. He added that the sphere of cooperation must be, quote, "enlarged to include diplomacy and defence and large parts of social and cultural policy," end quote. As a result, the attendees at the committee's 14th session, which took place on the 11th of March 1969, included members from all three major British political parties, all of whom sat not as private individuals, but as nominated representatives of their parties. The meeting was held in London and was a key moment in luring of Britain into the Brussels EU. Meetings of the Action Committee for the United States of Europe were held throughout the 1960s and only concluded after 1973, when Britain had joined the European Economic Community. Decimalisation of the British currency, first step towards scrapping the pound. To the designers of the Brussels EU, a key step in helping to ensure that its member countries were unable to leave the bloc was the creation of a single European currency, the euro. The rationale behind this was simple. Scrapping a nation's currency and making it subject to the control of a cartel-controlled central bank reduces an autonomous country to a mere constituent state in a corporate-controlled superstate. Prior to the creation of the euro, the monetary systems of the six founding member countries of the Brussels EU had all utilised currencies based upon subunits of 100. As such, it was obviously decided that the pan-European single currency would similarly utilise subunits of 100. Given, however, that Britain's currency, the pound sterling, the world's oldest currency still in use, was based until 1971 upon subunits of 240, harmonisation of the decimal-based systems of the six founding member countries was deemed necessary before the British people could be coerced into ditching the pound and accepting a pan-European single currency based upon subunits of 100. Thus was born what eventually came to be known as the decimalisation of Britain's currency. The announcement that Britain was to go decimal was made on the 1st of March 1966 by the then Chancellor of the Exchequer, James Callaghan, who described it as a, quote, historic and momentous decision, although the real reasons behind the change were never fully disclosed to the British people. Callaghan admitted publicly that large sections of industry, commerce and banking had concluded it would benefit the economy. Needless to say, Callaghan's precise reasoning as to why Britain's 240 subunit system of currency was somehow responsible for holding back the British economy was never made clear. Despite this, the new decimal currency went ahead and was launched across the country on the 15th of February 1971. Edward Heath, the man who delivered Britain to the Brussels EU. Britain joined the EU in January 1973 under its then Prime Minister Edward Heath, a man who had long harboured a desire to bind the country into a European federation. In his inaugural parliamentary speech given on the 26th of June 1950 upon entering the British House of Commons, Heath openly called on the government to join the Schuman Plan, presented by the French Foreign Minister Robert Schuman. Only a month prior to Heath becoming member of the British Parliament, the Schuman Plan ultimately led directly to the creation of the Brussels EU. Heath was well connected with the elite of the cartel, attending a meeting of the clandestine Bilderberg Group in 1976 and addressing a meeting of the Rockefeller-led Trilateral Commission in 1980, holding the post of British Prime Minister between 1970 and 1974. He was also a friend of the Glaxo Drug Company chairman and chief executive Sir Austin Bide, the man described by Britain's Independent newspaper as being principally responsible for the transformation of Glaxo from a company best known for its baby foods into a world force in the pharmaceutical industry. Significantly, it's notable that Bide, while seconded to Glaxo during World War II, had worked on vitamins and penicillin and was also responsible for patents. Another close friend of Heath was Eric Rolle, later to become Baron Rolle of Ipsden and a member of the British House of Lords. Rolle, also a frequent Bilderberg meeting attendee and a member of the group's powerful steering committee, but Bide and Rolle were by no means Heath's only controversial associates. After French President Charles de Gaulle had vetoed Britain's entry into the Brussels EU during the 1960s, Heath invited the ex-Nazi lawyer Walter Hallstein, by then President of the European Commission, to Chequers, his prime ministerial country residence, to examine why the entry had failed. This visit was one of several that Hallstein made to Chequers during Heath's tenure as prime minister. Behind the scenes, during the decade leading up to Britain joining the EU in 1973, Hallstein and Heath met on numerous occasions and worked closely together. In recognition of their close working relationship, Hallstein even contributed the foreword to the German edition of Andrew Roth's 1973 book, Edward Heath, Ein Mein für Europa, From this, by his own account, it's clear Holstein used Heath as his barometer of determining the political temperature before official meetings and negotiations on the UK's application to join the EU bloc, promising to be at Heath's side in pushing through Britain's membership. It's equally clear that Holstein was determined for the country to join the Brussels EU, regardless of any opposition from the British people. Notably, therefore, Holstein summed up Heath's role in delivering Britain into the arms of the Brussels EU by stating outright that, quote, the success of this battle was to a decisive extent his victory. Heath lost power in 1974 to Harold Wilson's Labour Party, whose election manifesto had committed it to allowing the British people a referendum on whether Britain should stay in the common market on renegotiated terms or leave it entirely. In the campaign that preceded the referendum, which took place on the 6th of June 1975, the millionaire businessman Alistair McAlpine, who later became treasurer of Heath's Conservative Party, acted as campaign treasurer for the Yes side. Speaking to the Independent newspaper in June 2005, McAlpine admitted that, quote, the banks and the big industry companies put in very large sums of money to the Yes side. The Independent also described how, according to an organiser of the Yes campaign, Caroline de Courcy Ireland, the Yes side additionally had the benefit of money from the European Commission, whose funding was used to charter a series of 100-seater jet planes from British Caledonian Airlines to fly almost 1,000 pro-European speakers to briefings given by top-level Eurocrats. Revealingly, de Courcy Ireland described the money as, quote, a sort of special dispensation from the Commission, end quote. Faced with the referendum question, do you think the UK should stay in the European Community, common market, the Yes side's massive cooperation and European Commission funding ensured that just over 67% of voters voted in favour. After the vote, Heath admitted that he'd worked for this for 25 years. To this day, the 1975 vote remains the only referendum the British people have ever had on Europe. Will the British people fight to maintain their freedom and independence? Through the passing of the Lisbon Treaty, almost everything that Göring, as head of German Luftwaffe during World War II, had been trying to obtain for the cartel is on the verge of being achieved. As such, the great loss of life and selfless sacrifice that took place in order to overcome the corporate greed that led to two world wars will all have been in vain, unless the British people are prepared to fight to maintain their freedom and independence. Clearly, therefore, although Britain has consistently been on the right side in global battles against the oil and drug cartel, unless her people now fight back against the Brussels EU and its takeover of their country, everything that their fathers and grandfathers fought for in the past will have been lost. End of chapter 6.